Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by CreativeBug.com, bringing top designers and crafters into your home with online creative classes. Talented instructors can teach you simple or intricate crafts at your own pace whenever you want. Sign up for a CreativeBug premium membership and get your first month free. Just go to CreativeBug.com and use the promo code XX. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron sends gourmet recipes and all the fresh ingredients you need to make them right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by visiting blueapron.com/XX. That's DOUBLEX. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, December 25th, the Righteous Feminist Outrage Edition. I'm June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ section. Hannah Rosen is busy this week, so I'm here in the New York studio with Slate staff writer Amanda Hess. Hello, Amanda.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. And with New York Magazine's Noreen Malone. Hello, Noreen.
Hey, June.
Okay, our three topics for today are all suffused with end-of-year reflections. They are the current state of feminist outrage, how television treated women this year, and finally, our wish list for 2015. Last Thursday, Slate published a huge package on outrage. It had an amazing interactive that pinpointed a representative outrage for every day of 2014 and asked readers to vote whether the outrage was justified or overblown. And there was also a series of essays on topics like the etymology of the word. It had pieces about conservative outrage and liberal outrage, cultural outrage, and a wonderful essay by Amanda about the rigid conventions of identity outrage. Amanda, perhaps you can begin by defining identity outrage.
I'll certainly try. So, outrage in general is, as Katie Waldman wrote in her essay explaining exactly the phenomenon that we're talking about, is it's not exactly rage. It's a type of anger that is politicized in a way and is sort of transgressing some sort of boundary. And a lot of times we think about that boundary as something that's acceptable to be angry about. So if you're outraged, you're angrier than you should be. But in a lot of ways, I think it's also being angry about something that maybe mainstream society doesn't really want to listen to. So identity outrage, which is outrage over racial topics or gendered topics, I think can be in both of those categories. So people can go overboard, but also they can be throwing truth bombs that people don't really want to hear.
Right. I mean, there is often, it feels, a performative aspect to it. But as you had a really nice line in your piece where, you know, you observed that social media is fundamentally democratizing. And you said it allows people who have been boxed out of journalistic, academic and political spaces to speak out about their lived experiences and call on the elites to address their own unexamined entitlements. I mean, that is unassailably a positive. Like, now we all have, what are those things called? Now we all have printing presses.
She was making a cranking motion for people who didn't have the benefit of that.
Now we all have printing presses, and so that's great, but it can, you know, it does seem like social media is also a kind of a way of removing nuance and adding anger, right?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing is that there aren't just a few people who are controlling how we can talk to each other. The bad thing is that there's a new structure that has grown up that can make it more difficult for us to actually understand each other. Mm-hmm. And so in my essay, I recalled a bunch of incidents that happened over the last year where gender or racial outrage was used maybe for ill instead of for good, or maybe just for like boredom or anger at some other issue. So one of the things I talk about is that on social media, our like identity outrage is like really based on avatars. So the reason that I talk about race and gender is because I think that they're the easiest to communicate like through our Twitter avatars and in like a 160 character bio. But sometimes those images can be deceiving. So in one case over the summer, there was an international women's conference that was held in Paris. And a photo from the conference started getting passed around on social media because it showed like five or six male CEOs all sitting alone on stage. And this was perfect for identity outrage because it was ironic, it was visual, and it was passed around, you know, to people like Will Wheaton, who have a very big platform, and people just sort of snarking at it and then sort of growing an outrage that this women's conference would have been dominated by men. Actually, the conference was almost exclusively attended by women, and this shot...
And the panelists were also women.
Yeah, and the organizers were women, the panelists were women, and this shot just happened to be one moment when a bunch of men were called on stage basically to account for their male privilege and to talk about how they can make their companies more accommodating to women. So arguably, it was a good thing.
Or you also have the example of Anna Holmes, who was kind of yelled at for displaying white privilege, or, you know, people use the hideous meme that I just get on my nerves, X tears, and they said she was shedding white tears, and she isn't white.
Right.
But it wasn't clear from her avatar. And then someone used the classic line that you quoted, not true, but memed forever.
Yeah. That was one of the most, I think, unintentionally hilarious things that happened in my social media sphere this year, where Anna had taken to Twitter, like we all do, to complain about a noise in her neighborhood,
right.
And it was a guy on the bongos. And then another person took that tweet and made fun of her, saying that she was like a typical white gentrifier who was trying to suppress like black music. And when she weighed in to say, actually, I'm black and I live in a pretty gentrified neighborhood, so I assume that the guy on the bongos was like a white dude, no one really stepped back when they realized that she was black. They were just like, whatever. It already happened.
Right.
So I think, I mean, in a lot of cases, like the case with the male CEO photos, after you point that out, a lot of people sort of feel shame and they take it back. But at a certain point, you can't take it all back. As one guy said, it's like forever memed. Yeah.
So I have a question. These are sort of ridiculous examples where people took everything out of context. But what about other cases where, like, let's say that those men had not been called on stage to publicly account for their sins. Let's say it had been a feminist, you know, as you often have on, say, Fox News, where it's a panel of men or like of white men talking about race relations or something pertaining to women, that's not an uncommon thing. So in that case, what is the good of policing? Is there good that comes out of this policing that is happening so much on Twitter?
I mean, I refer to that process as a sort of chipping away at the institutions of racism and patriarchy. And I think it can be argued that that is a good thing. And so if you think of all of activist Twitter as like a rolling think piece, everyone is sort of like contributing anecdotes and examples that are building this argument against these structures.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of looking at it. But another way of looking at it is that the structure itself is sort of getting away without much critique because we are focusing all individually on these small examples.
Jamel Bowie had a nice piece in the Outrage package where he sort of pointed out at the growth of, you know, if you judge from Twitter and to a lesser extent Facebook, you would think that, you know, the internet had been taken over by, or not the internet had been taken over, but that the world had become a place really committed to social justice. And in fact, when you look at, you know, what's happening in politics, it kind of doesn't seem that way. I mean, it feels like, gosh, we're going to have a GOP Congress and abortion rights are under fire all the time. And, you know, freedoms are actually being removed. So it's almost as if people are getting it out of their system in sort of tweeting or, you know, policing language or doing these things. But it's almost as if they're compensating for the lack of, you know, success in the real world. Or is that too harsh, do you think?
Well, it's like those are huge systems that it's very, very, talk about chipping away at something. It's very difficult to shift an electorate or to make sure that every state doesn't roll back abortion rights. Those are huge tasks that you can't, you know, as one person sort of do, but you can share a Facebook link about the injustice in Ferguson.
Right.
And so it is easy to sort of be like, oh, it's social media activism is lazy, it's facile, but it also, it comes from a place of good usually.
Yeah. And yeah, if you can't speak, then, you know, what can you do?
Yeah. But I mean, one of the most interesting things I thought about Jamel's essay was that he noted that for outrage on the left, it's most often like liberals complaining about other liberals.
Yes.
To other liberals, because they're the people who actually care about, you know, feminism and representation.
Mm-hmm. Privilege.
Yeah.
And the left has a longer history of policing itself than the right does.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think we should all talk about whatever. This is what we're doing right now.
Right.
But it's interesting to look at what we're actually saying and who's listening to us.
Can we talk about specifically the feminist outrage of 2014?
Yes, yes.
So I went through, I didn't go through the full list, which is amazing. I'm so jealous that Slate did this outrage package. It's really good. But I gotta say, a lot of the things that, so the way it was set up, it gave you sort of the one sentence version of what the outrage had been from that particular day of the year. And then it told you, like, which people were upset. So it was, like, feminists, school teachers, parents, whoever was angry about this particular one. And a lot of the ones the feminists were upset over, I gotta say, they just don't move me, and they never moved me. And I'm a little worried that we are wasting all our energy on this stuff. So I'll read just from basically the month of January. We were upset about Lena Dunham being criticized for being naked. Other people were upset about Woody Allen, Lena Dunham in Vogue, the Jezebel retouching. There was some mishigas over a Barbie programmer who Barbie learned to be a programmer.
Oh.
It just, none of these things.
Well, Woody Allen was...
Woody Allen, fine. But I, you know, I wouldn't call that a feminist issue. That's like a human rights,
yeah,
justice system thing.
I mean,
fucks
it kind
everything
of,
up,
yeah,
thing.
It reflects like the power of the patriarchy and all that. But yeah.
Okay. But
fair
we spent
enough.
Two full days in January being out. We, the internet, some collective of people spent two full days defending Lena Dunham or attacking Lena Dunham's body in January. That just seems crazy.
Well, I think that's kind of a reflection, though, about how much Lena Dunham in specific has become this almost, you know, weaponizable, monetizable, you know, she's like Semtex in human form. I mean, you can, any story about Lena Dunham will get people engaged. I mean, so on a slow day, it's just so tempting to, anything about Lena Dunham will get people talking.
Totally. But I guess my bigger question is, did all of our feminist, and I cherry picked very much, but did any of our feminist outrage get us anywhere in 2014?
I mean, this is another example that I'm not sure how I feel about, but I think feminist outrage changed some NFL policies.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
I think it put a lot of colleges on notice about how they deal with sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
But even in those big institutions, I have to think, like, the reason that we are asking Roger Goodell, of all people, to, like, deal with domestic violence,
right,
in the United States is because we have so little faith in our actual criminal justice system,
mm-hmm,
to deal with that crime and with the crime of sexual assault effectively. But who am I going to tweet at,
right,
about that? Nobody.
At Roger Goodell, call your senator.
Yeah, exactly. So I think those could be considered victories in a way, in that they, the NFL has a lot of money and a lot of power, and colleges also have, you know, a degree of control over young women's lives. And so I'm just not sure what to do about that, but I guess channeling it toward the NFL is not the worst,
right,
thing we could do.
It also, I mean, Willa pointed out that although it can feel like, you know, cultural outrage in the sense of where you, you know, get on TV creators' cases for their terrible diversity or for horrible jokes or just for, you know, just get on their cases, it can seem reductive and not very, you know, artistic or not really responding to it as a, to their work as a piece of art. But it has really brought changes. I mean, and people do it because they're passionate about what they're watching, and they, you know, that it comes from a really engaged place, which we all hear now is the key to, you know, success. And it's great that it has put the creators of shows on notice. They might still make some horrible characters, but they know they're going to get a hard time for it, at least from someone. And just that awareness maybe saves us from a lot of horrible, you know, representations.
Right. I mean, I do think there is this big overlap with consumerism and outrage, where something like TV creators, there's a direct relationship,
yeah,
even though many of us don't really pay for TV anymore. We have something we can withhold, which is, if not our dollars, then our eyeballs. And so I think that says a lot about the paths that outrage goes down.
There is this phenomenon, though, recently, though, Noreen, where it seems like people are responding more according to what camp they sort of associate themselves with or they identify with, rather than the specifics of the issue. I mean, you had a great quote in your piece, Amanda, from a Jezebel editor who talked about just kind of the way that what we can talk about is shrinking. You know, there's so much that's being policed that, you know, I mean, we know, we sometimes talk about, oh, we're going to hear from people about this. That is, you know, a relatively minor recognition of it. But there is a little bit of a stifling of speech because you are kind of predicting the outrage that's going to come, whether or not you really think it's justified, but you just know it's coming anyway.
Yeah, I think there are, for both good and bad, a set of pieties in every sort of ism. And feminism happens to be the one that we spend a lot of time talking about and thinking about on this show. But it's true that even, you know, when was the heyday of Jezebel? 2007, 2008. I loved reading Jezebel. It felt like you could call yourself a feminist and think about things in a feminist way without being earnest isn't quite the right word, but sort of women's studiesy about it. Not that there's anything wrong with women's studies, but
you're doing it.
Right. I'm doing it. And so, you know, last week when we were planning to do this whole show on the UVA rape mess, I was really nervous because I knew it is an incredibly sensitive issue, first of all, just on its merits,
right,
but also that it felt like a booby trap, right? Like any wrong word that you say, you know you're going to get emails and letters and tweets, and they will be heartfelt, but they also will be angry, and they will be, you know, I thought you were on my team, you're actually on the other team, and if you aren't for us, you're against us, you know, that right, whole thing. And Amanda wrote what I thought was a very smart piece in response to the UVA thing. She said, you know, feminism doesn't need Jackie. All these people were saying, oh, if Jackie's lying, you know, the whole movement is screwed over. And other people were saying, like, I believe Jackie because she's representative of all rape victims everywhere. No, Jackie is just Jackie. This is a very particular incident. And you don't have to divide into camps based on one side or the other.
But people do, don't they, Amanda?
I think Jezebel's a good case study for this, because when they started, they started in opposition to traditional women's media, which was very light and appearance oriented and didn't talk about things that women actually care about. But now traditional women's media is made in Jezebel's image. So it's feminist or it's feminist light. And so for places like Jezebel or for XX, I think the challenge is to still, you know, represent our own feminism while challenging what is now this traditional media and injecting something new in the conversation. And sometimes if that goes against the party line, it can seem offensive or anti-feminist. But I'm hoping that if we look at the big picture, we can see that there are so many feminist voices in media right now, and it can accommodate a lot.
That feels like an awesome place to leave that topic. So before we move on to our next topic, Noreen, tell us about our first sponsor.
Our sponsor is Blue Apron, the delivery service. So here's how it works. $9.99 per meal, and it sends you a refrigerated box, and it has the right high quality ingredients, the exact right proportions, and simple step-by-step recipe instructions. And they come from local farms, so you'll be getting produce it's in season, just like if you'd gone to the green market and been the kind of pulled together person who knows how to do that
and gets up in time for there still to be anything there.
500 to 700 calories a serving, and they'll work on your schedule and your dietary preferences. So if you, you know, are a vegetarian or don't eat gluten, you can find something, a Blue Apron. June, are you a big cook?
I am not a big cook, not a small cook, really not a cook. Everything that I eat pretty much comes from either my girlfriend cooks, which is good, or
good for you.
No, it's good for me. Or much more frequently, delivery service.
I like to cook, but I end up working late a lot and then come home and eat, you know, either delivery or just like granola, the sad granola and yogurt dinner. So Blue Apron would be a solution to that. They can work around your busy schedule if you're someone like me who, you know, needs the delivery to come, say, early in the morning and then just be in the fridge. Or if you're someone who, you know, is out the door in the morning and needs it at night, they can do that. So if you want to try it out, you can get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/gabfest. That's two free meals just for going to blueapron.com/gabfest.
Okay, moving on to our second topic. This week, Slate is running its annual TV club in which four critics, this year it's Slate's TV critic Willa Paskin, Time Magazine's James Poniewozik, The Huffington Post's Mo Ryan, and me, look back at the year on the little box in the living room, or increasingly these days at the laptop, wherever you happen to be. It seems that all the critics agreed that this is a really good year for diversity on television. As Willa put it, diversity of genre, type and form. Anti-heroes are in decline, and women and trans people and soft-hearted female cops and pot-smoking 20-something New Yorkers are in ascendance. Does it feel that way to you as someone who claims they don't have a lot of time to watch television, Noreen?
Well, so I said that to you guys over email as we were discussing, you know, planning what we were going to talk about. And I went through last night and I realized basically all I do is watch TV. I watch so much fucking TV. So I don't know, because I have sort of siloed off my own tastes in TV. And looking at the list altogether, it does suggest that I tend to watch things that are probably correlated with like my gender and where I live, and my socioeconomic status. But I'll give you a quick list of things I really liked on TV this year.
Awesome.
Veep is like my favorite show on TV.
The best.
I watched Some New Girl, Mindy Lahiri, The Mindy Project. I identify with her deeply.
Wow.
I can talk about that later. Girls, Silicon Valley, Looking, Dahl and M, Orange is the New Black, Broad City was like my favorite show on television this year.
Yeah.
And then Nashville is secretly my favorite show on television. I am addicted to it.
It is funny how many people are still watching Nashville. I gave it up.
It's not funny. It's great. Let's keep it on the air.
What do you watch, Amanda?
Mostly murder shows.
Me too. I love a murder show too.
I love the murder shows. That's about it.
Which murder shows?
This year I watched The Fall, which is, maybe you know better, June, where does that come from?
It's a BBC show. It's set in Belfast, and it has the amazing Scully, what's her name?
Gillian Anderson,
who looks like she's aging in reverse. She looks so fantastic on that show. And she plays this sort of English cop who goes over to Belfast and is, you know, in the middle of some ridiculous, very complicated, politicized case, when, meanwhile, a very creepy but very handsome, right?
Mm-hmm.
Serial, sexual, just murder creep is going about his creepy business.
Yeah, and he's played by Jamie Dornan, who will be playing Christian Grey in the 50 Shades of Grey movie, which is coming out in February, which signals it's going to be terrible, but I'm probably going to see it anyway. And she also, like, has sex with like everything that moves. So I find her a really fascinating character, and I get my murder show and then my like sexy times in that show too, and I'm obsessed with it.
Well, this is that actually sex was another thing that felt like it became diversified this year. You know, we saw there was this amazing 69 scene in The Americans, in the first episode of season two of The Americans, that just felt like it was kind of breaking some barriers, even though it was not particularly by what it showed, but just it was this very intimate, very loving moment that did happen to be seen by the couple's daughter. But, you know, it really got to those questions of power and pleasure and, you know, what these people who use sex in their business, how they kind of show affection to each other. We've seen, you know, there's a gay man in How to Get Away with Murder, which I believe is one of your murder shows, right?
It is one of them, yeah.
who, you know, uses his sexuality, again, almost like a weapon. It's like his, you know, how some old-time, you know, investigators used to use their Rolodexes. You know, he uses his penis. And as Brian Lauder pointed out in Slate, there's a lot of bottom
shin. So he rifles through it on his desk or what? Like, I want to know.
You got to watch to find out.
After dark.
Double X after dark. And I just recently watched Outlander, which I know was getting a lot of, I mean, I saw a lot of tweets about it, especially from women and some gay men. And I understood why. I mean, it's very much, there's a lot of sex, or actually, there's really not that much. It just kind of seems a lot, I think, because it comes from a different perspective from the one we usually get. Like, the central character is definitely the female lead. The men are the secondary ones. She objectifies them in a certain sense, but what she does to the men that she's around, is not like what male leads do with the women around them typically.
Yeah, and it's also set various centuries in the past.
Right.
So I think, you know, when she is on a honeymoon with her husband and he goes down on her and she does not really reciprocate, it feels, I guess, more exciting because right. It's like old-timey sex.
He's wearing a suit before he did that.
Yeah. But there's also I think Outlander is one of the shows, and the other ones we mentioned too, this is happening too, where there's a degree of sexualized violence in the show that I find sort of interesting. And one of the ways that they present it is, you know, she has this husband who is this guy who goes down on her, and then she goes back a few centuries in the past, and she meets his ancestor, who's played by the same actor, who is a sociopath who assaults her. Yeah, it was a sadist. And so I'm not sure exactly how I feel about that. I certainly mm-hmm. found it interesting as a viewer, but I also, it gave me the creeps sort of like as a person a
yeah.
little bit.
And on some shows like Game of Thrones, I mean, there's so much rape and some that just isn't even in the books. I mean, certainly that's a show that has a huge amount of, you know, kind of background characters being despoiled in very cruel ways.
Well, can I offer you guys a solution?
Yes.
Don't watch all these fucking costume dramas. Watch some modern stuff, man. In the 21st century, which is where I live on my television set, this stuff doesn't happen.
I have to say that you mentioned Broad City. The scene of Ilana getting it on with Lincoln while Skyping Abby is absolutely the most sexually liberated thing ever, right? Although also a little bit
not
scary.
Sexy. Not sexy.
It's all sexy.
Do you guys care if the shows you watch have a, quote, woman problem?
It's funny, in the TV club, Willa, like, asked for us to come up with a new phrase for that because
I hate it.
It sounds like a skin condition, but I mean, it depends. If the show is interesting, I don't know. I think that Game of Thrones is the only show that I watch that has a woman problem. Which shows are we thinking of?
Well, like, people complained about True Detective. I mean, I had my complaints with True Detective, but they involved the ending and all the loose threads, not so much the women.
Yeah. I think if a show has a woman problem, it raises the bar for me to be interested and to watch it.
Yeah.
Because I'll watch a bunch of terrible shows that star women. Game of Thrones, for example, because I conceive of it in my head as, like, medieval aliens raping each other. I'm just, like, I'm not interested in watching it.
Yep.
And True Detective, my problem with that show was that I thought it was a bad show.
Yeah. So like, dramatically inert.
Yeah.
With good actors.
But, I mean, in the typical form of internet outrage, you know, once I decided that the show was bad, it made it easier to be like, well, and also, Nick Pizzolatto hates women, you know? It was easier to indulge in that. Whereas if he had made a good show, I wouldn't have minded.
Okay. Before we go on to our final topic, let's hear about our second sponsor.
Our second sponsor today is Creative Bug. I don't know about you guys, but I was the kind of kid who took art museum classes, and I always had you know, a lot of art projects going, and I made jewelry, and I tried to learn how to needlepoint. I was really into all that stuff, and I haven't done that in probably 12 years, you know?
My goodness. that's a big chunk of your life.
Since the moment I went away to college. Anyway, for a lot of adults, that's not part of our lives, and creativebug.com brings designers and crafters, some of whom have been featured in O Magazine, Martha Stewart Living, which is like the holy grail of, you know, any kind of DIY elegance, into your own home. So what Creative Bug does is it will let you try a new craft, like making jewelry or homemade marshmallows for the holidays. So what Creative Bug will do is give you step-by-step instructions and the tools and techniques you need to bring your own personal style into all of these crafts. What would you guys like to craft for the holidays if you could?
I would just like to learn to knit because my mom and my grandma were these fantastic knitters, and I used to get all these compliments for the sweaters. My grandma would make these really cool things. I had one with my name on it that she knit, you know, like it was part of the pattern. It was awesome. And I had lots of them. And I tried to learn to knit when I was a kid, and I think the teacher was really worried about me because all I produced was like this tight gray mess. And so I would like to remedy that.
I would be really into, I don't know if you can do this on Creative Bug, but I've long wanted to learn to metalwork in order to create my own jewelry on another scale, not just beading. So I will look into that, and you should look into that too at home, creativebug.com. And if you sign up for premium on creativebug.com and enter the promo code XX, you'll redeem a free month of access to these hundreds of exclusive classes, which are added to and updated weekly. So again, creativebug.com, promo code XX, and your first month is free.
Okay, finally, since it's the time for resolutions, we're going to offer our feminist wish list for 2015. Noreen, would you like to go first?
Sure. We were only supposed to come up with one, but I have like five. I'm really greedy.
You're so wishy.
It's, you know, it's Christmas. So my big one, which we sort of talked about earlier, is that I think we as feminists should try to be less policing and more inclusive for the greater good of women and men. Mm-hmm. And then another one is that I would like Elizabeth Warren to run for president.
Whoa.
I mean, I prefer her to Hillary, but also I would just love to see two women fighting it out and not hopefully being judged on the merits of their policy positions, which are actually somewhat different than just like, I don't know, do I like that lady better or that lady?
But that's not how you would make the choice. What pantsuit is she wearing today? I prefer that one.
Her hair.
Yeah.
And then my last one is sort of a silly one, but I feel it very deeply. I would like women to stop saying the word boobs so much.
Boobs.
I'm the person, and
do you hear that word a lot? Because I'm not sure I did.
Yeah, I think people have begun to refer to breasts as boobs instead of breasts. And I find it, first of all, like somewhat coarse, but that's not my major issue with it.
This is the one who said fucking earlier, so I don't know, whatever.
I think you're going to hear my greater theory of breasts, but I think that a boob is a specific type of bosom. And
what kind?
Like a, you know, like bouncy Kate Upton thing, right? And not every woman has that sort of rack. And some women have small, perky breasts, and we should describe them as tits if we want to be descriptive. But most women just have breasts, which are a thing of dignity, and that is how we should describe them. And that is my great feminist wish
for 2015.
I am so
inspired now. Thank you. Thank you, Noreen.
Go out and say breasts.
All right. Amanda, what are your, what's your agenda?
I'm done with the breast thing. I think that's fine. But also,
great. The movement is building.
We've all bought in.
But it is policing.
Oh, that's true. It is policing. Oh, my gosh.
It's really tough. Feminism is tough.
I just want to gently encourage everyone to think of their dignity.
So I want another sort of tone policing to end, and that is people complaining about women's voices, namely...
Preach.
Vocal fry. And uptalk.
That's pretty
just
good.
Just like, listen to what I have to say. Like, just like, just like, shut up and let women talk. What is the big deal?
Oh, I so agree. The obsession with vocal fry and uptalk is so it's such misogyny, even when it comes from women. I know a lot of women have this response, but nevertheless, it's such a sexist notion because we, not at all, it's such a sexist notion and we only ever hear complaints about women's voices. Men do it too. Men do vocal fry. Maybe to a lesser extent, they do uptalk. People often send emails to the Slate podcast alias telling, can you tell that girl, they often say, to fix her voice? Like, well, actually, no. Actually, no. She can't fix her. People talk like they talk. And it makes me crazy that people police. Okay, we're overusing this term, but people police voices. It's so offensive and it's so sexist.
Imagine if we were judging people's appearance the way we judge voices. Like, I don't know, I hate fat chicks. Like, that's like, yeah, being like, I hate girls who uptalk. It's kind of the same thing.
Preach. Okay, we've solved that problem. Anything else from you, Amanda?
No, that's it.
That's the one thing feminism needs to do.
Now I feel embarrassed about mine because I have... Maybe this is a sign of creative bankruptcy, but I've gone to the Lena Dunham well. It's a personal pledge on my own behalf. Like, it's just so easy to turn to Lena Dunham and to use her as... I mean, I actually think that the criticism that in the sense of writing about a show that Girls has received has mostly been fantastic. We've actually had discussions around sex and around creativity and around the ways of starting a life once you're kind of out of the family and out of the college that have really been great. And I love the show. And I think that she is a brilliant, perceptive person who just is able to kind of pinpoint things about being a creative person and about being a young person that are rarely heard. But, you know, I think that at this point, we don't really hear what we're saying. You know, we don't even hear the things we're saying ourselves. I mean, and she just elicits such strong reactions that I think we all just kind of, we have to stop because it's just too easy.
We have to stop, but she's your number one feminist wish for 2015. Sorry.
It's just so hard to do this, people. But I guess actually my main wish is that we do listen more and not just respond in, you know, it's back to even what we were talking about before. Like, actually listen or read what people say before we, you know, tweet the outrage. Listen to people rather than just kind of giving an identity to them and deciding that how we feel about that kind of person. So I will listen even to the critics of Lena Dunham and to Lena Dunham. Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, what do you want us to read, watch, or listen to?
So, speaking of TV, the main thing I've been watching TV-wise recently is just Gilmore Girls all day, all the time.
It's streaming on Netflix.
Streaming on Netflix, which is actually, other than HBO Go and the aforementioned Hulu, how I consume TV. And I watched it off and on when it was on the first time. I am actually the same age as the character Rory Gilmore, so I always compared myself to her. But it's definitely a flawed show in a lot of ways, and I can't stand either of the two main characters. I really can't. They are sort of awful in various different ways, but it is a really enjoyable show, and if Paris Geller and Emily Gilmore were to someday get a spinoff, that would displace Nashville as my number one TV show.
That would be half of Bunheads and half of How to Get Away with Murder. And it would be amazing. I want to recommend a show that's currently airing on Stars. It is from Britain and it's called The Missing. And it's clearly influenced by the McCann case where a British couple were vacationing in Portugal and their daughter went missing. In the show, a couple are vacationing in France when their young son disappears. And it's about the investigation. You know, it's about trying to figure out what happened to him. You know, there's two different time settings when it happened, and I think 6 years later or 8 years later. And it's just unpredictable, which is the thing I most value these days somehow. And I think really well acted. And just, there are about three more episodes left or two more. And I really don't know where it's going to go. I'm surprised every week. And so I really recommend The Missing. Amanda, what do you want us to watch or do or see?
So this weekend, I painted my apartment, which I'm not sure I recommend. It takes forever, but it is incredibly satisfying. But while I did it, I listened to Lana Del Rey's album that she released this year, Ultraviolence. I never really listened to her before. And I had this idea of her as being like a humorless Brooklyn horrific monster, basically. And actually, she is quite funny, and she makes fun of that image in her music, and I listen to it on repeat.
All right. On that note, we're going to end for the year. Thank you to our producer, Anne Hepperman, to the managing producer of Slate Podcasts, Joel Meyer, and to Andy Bowers, the executive producer of all the Slate Podcasts. If you'd like more information about our show, including links to the stories we've talked about and a list of the items we recommended, please visit our show page at slate.com/XX. You can leave comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. Or send an email to xxgabfest@slate.com. For Amanda Hess and Noreen Malone, I'm June Thomas. The XX Gabfest will be back with you in 2015. Happy New Year, everyone.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.